wanted to talk about a topic which is a little bit of a
controversial one.
What?
Controversial one.
As opposed to the other Holocaust topics, which aren't controversial at all, huh? I take it, Jeff, you're familiar with the Barenblatt trial?
Not actually, no. I'm reading this stuff and it's news to me. I know very much a lot about the Eichmann trial. I know a lot about the heart of perfidy.
Correct. So this is fascinating. So Jeff says very well that really Israel had three Holocaust trials. And this is by far the least well-known of the three, right?
What's it called?
It's called the Barenblatt trial.
Barenblatt. Okay. Sorry.
The Barenblatt trial is as follows. So again, everybody knows, people know the Eichmann trial, that goes without saying. And in terms of moral issues, there's very little in Eichmann about moral issues. You have to really dig, right, to find anything to talk about there. The bottom line is Eichmann was who he was, and he got what he deserved. That's really, again, obviously, should you just kill him in Argentina or you should bring him to trial, you know, the publicity behind it, right? That's the discussion, but that's about it. A more difficult one and a more popular one, which is something that Jeff referred to, which is something that we've surprisingly never spoke about, and we probably should at some point, is the story regarding the Kastner trial, right? That was the book Perfidy was based on that. And again, we spoke about it tangentially when we spoke about the Rebbes who decided to escape. So the Satmar Rebbe, among others, was on the Kastner train. We never really gave it its full workup that it deserved, but we're not going to now. The third one, which was surprisingly not well known, even though I start off here with an article from Time magazine, was the Barenblatt trial. The Barenblatt trial was the third. I think Kastner was in 58. Eichmann was about 61. Barenblatt, you'll see, is 63, 64. In the Barenblatt trial, are dealing with a fellow, very interesting, Hirsch Barenblatt, as you'll see in the article, was the assistant conductor of the Israel National Opera. Right? In 1958, the guy was just minding his own business. An introduction at a concert at a kibbutz, a member of the audience suddenly leapt up and shouted, "Barenblatt, I remember you, you murdered Jews."
Wow.
The concert broke up amidst angry confusion in 1961 after a police investigation. Barenblatt was arrested and charged under the Israeli law, punishing Nazis and their collaborators who were members of hostile organizations. We're not going to talk about it. I'll just mention that this is a very interesting law. Again, this isn't the halacha, this is law. Unlike other laws, this law said that Israel could try you even if you have been tried in another country on the same charges, even if you've been acquitted on the same charges. Basically, it got rid of the statute of limitations and said, not only will we go over to Nazis, but we'll go after Nazi collaborators. And this law became this case became a question of the Judenrat. As I'm sure many, if not all, know, when the Nazis took over a town, they commanded it through what was called the Judenrat, which was a Jewish organization. And they would tell this organization what they are to do. Among the things they would say is, give us 1,000 people. And it was the job of the Judenrat to hand over these Jews. And the question is, if you were a member of the Judenrat, you at least thought that you would have a better chance of survival. So that was the story of this guy, Barenblatt. He was not actually a member of the Judenrat. If you look into it, if anyone wants, I could send you a Yad Vashem, published a significant piece on this in English. And I'd be happy to email it to anybody who wants, who's more interested, to find out what the story is. And And basically what they are wanting to do is they want to go after them, saying that the people who chose to be members of the Judenrat did wrong.
There were a lot of rabbis that sat on those Judenrat boards.
No, actually not.
I thought there were.
No, again, if you look into the history, rabbis were almost never on the Judenrat. Sometimes, in the minority of the cases, they would check with the rabbi before they acted, but the majority of the cases, the rabbis were not. There's an interesting article that was published in 1991. We'll quote a little bit about it. It was very interesting. There is a yearly called Shana B'Shana, which is put out by the chief rabbinate. In 91, they printed an article regarding this. Interesting for many reasons, including the fact that it was written by a woman. A woman wrote a piece about this, and the chief rabbinate published it in their yearly Torah publication, which is interesting. So we're going through it. This is again the article from Time magazine in 1963. On the opening day, what looked to be a drawn-out trial, a Tel Aviv carpenter tearfully recalled that Baron Bless Jewish police once trooped back from a round up in Bedzin, loudly singing as from a victorious engagement. Described how they herded Jewish men, women, and children into trucks headed for Auschwitz. Even the streets wept, the witness said. Prosecutor Libay can see that Berenbaus saved maybe 10 or 20 Jews, but added, this court will have to decide whether to save his own soul, he was entitled to carry out the tasks of the Jewish police. So there you have it. The question is that you have this fellow Berenbaus, and someone's got to do it, and he saved himself by working as a commander, not in the Judenrat, it happened to be, in his case, the Jewish police. Defense attorney Arye Rosenblum, supporting Berenbaus' plea of innocence, that his conduct was justifiable and argued that he was acquitted of the clamorous charges after the war by a Polish court. The Jewish police, Rosenblum said, cannot be regarded as hostile to the Jewish people. Their intention was not hostility. They did not seek to exterminate Jews. They served what they deemed the best interest of the Jewish community under the worst possible circumstances. That was the article in Time magazine in its entirety, in case you are interested. As I mentioned, a piece was put up by Yad Vashem on this. And very interestingly, if you look at the, I should have gone beforehand, and in the case that was reported on in March 22nd, 1963 by Time magazine, they reported the fact that, in fact, Berenblatt had been convicted. That was half of the story. If you go to the overall story, right, so it says, due to Berenblatt's high position and the attempt to impose comprehensive culpability on all Judenrat members, his trial became an important milestone in the development of Holocaust memories as it pertained to the Jewish leadership at the time. In Berenblatt, the principal question raised throughout the essence of the Judenrat and its members, this had been the only attempt to respond to it. The trial took place before two instances. First, the case was tried in Tel Aviv District Court for Chaim Ehrlich, together with Yaakov Gavison and Michael Harpazi, from March 11th, 1963, to the concluding summations in October 17th, and the verdict on February 5th, 1964. The District Court convicted Berenblatt, sentenced 5 years in prison for being a member. Berenblatt's appeal was then heard by a special panel of the Supreme Court, Chief Justice Isaac Olshin, Justice Chaim Cohn, who earlier as Attorney General had been the prosecutor in the Kastner trial, fascinating, and Justice Moshe Landau, who was the presiding judge at the Eichmann trial in the district court.
So he was convicted of what? Being in the Judenrat?
He was convicted of being a member of an organization which supported the extermination of Jews.
I see. Okay.
On May 1st, 1964, the Supreme Court exonerated Berenblatt.
In what year?
1964, same year.
Oh, okay.
The two rulings were material different from one another and reflected the problem of any attempt to resolve the relevant issues in a judicial setting. Additionally and principally, however, they showed how problematic was to determine the true image of the Judenrat as reflected in the memory of the survivors. So again, this is the question that we will begin to deal with today, a very difficult question to say the least, and that is the question of how to react when dealing on an official level with the Nazis. Now, let's just talk it out a little bit to discuss what the issues are, and we'll begin to discuss it now, and then, of course, we'll have to go through it more later, is the Nazis have this plan, and the plan is the Nazis want what's called Ordnung. They want everything to be as calm and collected as possible, and by doing that, the Nazis very much want to keep the people calm till the last second, and by using the Jews themselves as the police, right? That, of course, will allow the people to remain calmer. Now, what if someone refuses to be on the Judenrat? So again, if you refuse to be on the Judenrat, the assumption is that all what's going to happen is they will either just pick someone else or more likely kill you and then pick somebody else. Right, you're not going to stop anything by making your statement.
Right,
right. That's true. On the other hand, this is a very, very nasty business.
It's a no-win.
Correct. It's a no-win situation where you're dealing with the highest and most serious of stakes. So the question is, how do you deal with this? That is the ultimate question here. So that being said, right, we begin with a discussion that we had last week. If you remember last week, the opening week, we were discussing the question of if you have a child that is crying in a bunker and there is a danger that that child's sounds will lead to a
discovery of the other people.
Discovery of everybody, right? In such a situation, right, are you allowed to kill the child? And among the things that we discussed last week is this idea of killing one to save many. Just to review, let's look at the first source, which is a source that we dealt with last week as well, and that is the Rambam. And the Rambam says, there is a group of women and a bunch of bandits come along and say, either hand over one of you for us to have our ways with, or we're going to go and rape you all. We don't give someone over. More related to us, or in the situation where you say, all right, you know, the enemy says, give us over one Jew to kill, or we're going to kill you all. Yargu kulo val yimsu lehem nefesh achas mi Yisrael. Vim yichdu lehem va'amru tnu lanu proni o naru ges kolchem. What if they say, don't just, we want that guy. Either you give us that guy or we'll kill you all. Im hoya mechuya misa kesheva ben bechru yitna osalem. If the person deserved it, right? If there is a criminal, then we are harboring the criminal right now. And they're saying, either you give over that criminal or we're going to kill you all, right? So in such a situation, right, we say that that in fact, rather than have everyone be killed, if the person actually deserves it, right, then what you do is you hand the person over.
Or their head.
Whatever is necessary.
Right.
However, if the person does not deserve it, in such a situation, what you do is you, in that case, say, listen, we're not going to pick out one person, but rather you kill us all. Now, applying that to the question at hand, so again, the most difficult case that you're going to be dealing with is the Judenrat. The Nazis said, listen, there are 4,000 Jews in the ghetto. Too many. Give us 1,000 of them or we're going to ship them out. We want the 1,000 that can't do hard labor. And everybody knows that these people are not going to be sent to Club Med. Right? Everybody knows that give us over 1,000 to kill. What would you say in that situation? According to this Rambam, right, are these people deserving of death?
No.
Obviously not, right? They didn't do anything to deserve death.
No.
So what's the story here?
I thought you don't give them over.
In that case, you have to say, I'm sorry, we're not going to give them over. Then the Nazis will come in and kill everybody?
Right.
So the answer, according to that Rambam, would be, so be it. On the other hand, there's a second Rambam.
Of course there is.
Of course there is, or else I wouldn't be able to be giving a class about this. We'd have to go home now.
That's right.
That'd be terrible. So what does the second Rambam say? The Rambam says, what? Right? There's no place like home. There's no place like home. So the Rambam says, Kol ha-yachol la-hatzil v'lo-hitzil over al-losamo del-damre-yecha. If I have the ability to save a life and I don't save the life, I have sinned. Kleiner Ros Chaveiro Toveya Beyam, O Listin Baum Olav, O Chayera Baalav, V'yachol la-hatzil, Hu ba'asmo, O Sheyizkar Achem la-hatzilo. I see someone who's drowning, or I see someone who's in danger that they're about to run after the guy. And, you know, there are bandits that are going to step in. And I don't save the person, or I could hire someone to save the person. Or I hear that people are planning against him, or they've dug a pit for the person to fall into. Right, and I could somehow talk him out of it. I know someone wants to kill someone else, and I could stop it, but I don't. In such a situation, the Rambam says that's a sin. So think about this: 4,000 Jews in the ghetto. The Nazis say, give us 1,000 or we're going to kill them all. According to the first Rambam, we say everyone should die. We're not going to do it.
Right.
But according to the second Rambam, I could save 3,000 lives.
Okay, but Rabbi, that's an unrealistic depiction of what actually happened. Because it wasn't 1,000 and we won't kill 3,000. It send us 1,000 now and we'll take the others later. And so again, everybody do that.
Would you agree to this statement? Send us 1,000 and we will not kill the other 3,000 now.
Yes, that's true.
And if not, we will kill them all now.
I don't think that was ever made explicit. And that's part of the problem. Because you have two Rambams, but they're slightly different situations, and you have to decide which one applies.
Correct.
They're not necessarily in contradiction. They're slightly different situations.
So from what I'm hearing from you, Jeff, you think that the first Rambam is probably the one that applies here.
I am not sure, because they didn't ever explicitly say, give us 1,000 or we'll kill you all. They said, give us 1,000 now.
And there was never an alternative. Or you can have what's behind door number three.
Right. It wasn't like that. It's not as simple. And certainly there were very complicated cases behind this. What's his name? Barenthal. There's the case of Leo Beck in Berlin.
Right.
And when he got out of the camps afterwards, went to London, and they were naming the reform schools after him, there were a lot of people who objected.
Yeah.
I mean, so If we're discussing the Barenthal trial, we have two Rambams, both of which I don't think the exact situation is what's here. So we can extrapolate from them or interpolate from them, but that we cannot apply them directly.
Right. So, but as I said, if obviously it ain't that easy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fine.
Right. And that's the question.
I accept that.
And that's the Barenblatt, right? Barenblatt got up there and said, listen, you know, I had entree into there. I was able to, was I successful? Could I save everybody? No. Right. So again, this is interesting because Jeff, how would you say comparing this to Kastner?
Well, I'm not going to make the comparison to Kastner because I think a lot of the story we've told been told about Kastner is a lie.
So compare it to the lie we've been told about Kastner.
Well, Kastner made a deal with the Nazis. In return, he got, theoretically, he got some of these famous rabbis, including Yoelitch and Teitelbaum.
Correct. I mean, whatever.
By the way, I now am going to announce something which I don't talk about very often. The Sabari Rav was rescued from Auschwitz. The man who did it was named Yisrael Hecht. He was my uncle.
Mm-hmm. Who was rescued?
And he made a deal with the Nazis where he got out and other
Jews. Right, so again, we're not talking about it, but in both cases, right, the Kastner argument was, you know, listen, it's okay, it's bad, deal with the devil in order to save lives. Right? Isn't that ultimately the argument that he makes?
Okay, so the point is, okay.
Right, the question is the Judenrat argument that different? And the only difference is that Kastner's life neck wasn't on the line. Barenblatt's
no,
was.
No, Kastner himself wasn't on the line.
Correct.
But there were a lot of Jews' necks on the line, and they
absolutely
lost.
Absolutely. The only difference, the major difference here is
for people
Kastner
like
had nothing to gain.
Kastner listen, I can't hear you guys when you both
Blatt
talk.
Saved himself.
I have to tell you, I can't hear either of you when you talk over each other.
Mm-hmm. So that's the question here is, I was just pointing out that the difference in this case and the case of the Kastner train is in the Kastner train, Kastner's actually better off because Kastner personally had nothing to gain from this. You might have agreed, you might have disagreed with what he did, but he didn't have skin in the game.
And he did save people.
He did. Again, he did. But he might have killed people also by giving supplies to the Nazis.
Maybe.
Not even that complicated. He may have killed people because people who were on that train traded Jews for themselves. And that's what I say. Some of that's a lie.
Okay, whatever that is, you know, but the bottom line is Kastner himself did not gain.
True.
Barenblatt, it would seem, did. Barenblatt was a person who survived the war, perhaps because of his position. So the initial question that we have to deal with, and again, as I said, going forward, we'll deal with other Judenrat questions, is whether or not you're allowed to join the Judenrat. That's the so again, the only piece that I have found that discusses that question directly comes again from the volume that we mentioned the last week. The difference is I was able to go to the library today and actually pick up the book. Here it is, Show and Tell. This is Kol HaKosov L'Chaim, which is a Sefer Zikaron, what we call an Edos, a Feshrift, for a fellow Rav Chaim Taubes. And in it, they have different articles. And one article is a compilation of questions that were related to the Holocaust. And question number 6, page 318, She'elavav hamutar ishtatim b'moetzas Yehudim, Yudinrat, o b'mritziya Yehudish, she'hukma yideh tzor v'mata l'shamish kli ezer b'bitzua shitasi v'shakes es ha'molechas hashmada k'dei tol k'dei hashliya satzibor. Are you allowed to join the Yudinrat, basically, whose the whole purpose of it was to keep the people calm, which would basically help the murdering machine to keep it whistling along, right? כאילו אין סכנות חייהם. הם מותר לסייע בריכוז לתוך הגטוס בארגן הקהילה בשמירת הסדר בארגן עבודת כפייה למען הצורר. Basically, what are you doing? You're sending people to the ghetto. You're sending people to labor camps. You're choosing who goes where. בלי השכרה, בעלי מלאכה ואחרות, אם מותר למנוע מהציבור מידע בדבר קיומם ופרוסם של מחנות השמדה. Right? And you're allowed to tell people you have to line up when you know that these lineups aren't for a good reason. In the tshuva, he basically points to these two competing issues. On the one hand, you have the Rambam, the second one he quotes, Kol Yochel Atziv Lo Hitzil, dot, dot, dot. Right? The first two lines say, you have to save lives if you can. On the other hand, fight all you can. שכן יש בו משום סיור מרחס השמדה בטור שזהו בגדר אב ישראל של שפיחס דבים. We know that there are three cardinal sins. One of the three cardinal sins is murder. And not only is a person not allowed to murder to save their lives, but they can't even do something which is tangentially related to murder. And this would be something that would be definitely considered tangential to murder. Bottom line, literally the bottom line, ha'ola me'am akubatz le'er hu ki kein hein l'tshuva chiyuvis v'hein l'tshuva shchirish yeshamar l'smoch. In the end, he punts. He says, if you think it's yes, if you think it's no, according to either side, you have what to rely on. Basically, what he says is, I can't answer this. I can't answer this, and therefore, I'm not going to try. There are people, however, did answer. And I'll just give you an example of one of each. One is a published tshuva, which was published in the 1970s, long after the war. So this, of course, is not a practical, but it's only a theoretical. Alesho Asher Bishnos HaChorban Medinas Poland Hukmo Begetos Aydei HaRishon Mo Etzas Yudish Yudin Rat Palaz Matarash Masho Rishon Masel She Yehudim Ba'atzam Yisrael Abizas Mashmas Yehudim Rachman Litzlah. So he says that there was something called the Yudin Rat. The purpose of the Yudin Rat was that the Jews themselves should be involved in the terrible destruction that was going on. Ubegeto Achik Sharasham Darshum Yoshev Rosham Oatsam Sori Yodam Kama Rafa Yehudim. And one time they went to the person in charge and says, give over several thousand Jews. Vahala Yodashem del Kacham Rahariga. And he knew what that meant. Halachal Vibid Atzuladas. So what did he do? Did he give it over? Did he not give it over? He went and he killed himself. What did that accomplish?
He's not having to make a decision.
Well, yeah, that's one thing. However, it wasn't just for the sake of anyone to do it, but he used that as a sign. People who saw that the head of the Yudinrat killed himself knew that things must have been bad. And a lot of people ran away, and a lot of people hid. So that was his way of getting the message across that there's nothing good here. However, the evil begetto should be iracheres. Masai Yosef Roshi de Harishon kol pam kamarofi Yehudim. In a different ghetto, the person, in fact, listened. Then he gave over as they requested. From why Yehudim akluim begetto ki ayidei mesiras ma'atim lidei Rishon who matzil es asher. And his argument was, yes, I'm giving over these people to their death, but I am saving everybody else. But at the end, he gave over 100,000 Jews to their death. And in the end, they went and they took him also. So in hindsight, couldn't say
so we don't do this?
What?
So I'm saying if the situation came up today and they form a Judenrat and there would always be people that would step up for that. It sounds like we shouldn't even agree for a Judenrat.
So let's see. So let's see what he says here. So this is the Lahoros Nosson, Rav Nosson Gestetner, a contemporary. So he says, so they want to know. So he said, these are the two cases there that they had. The guy says, listen, I understand it's very hard to ask this question. However, he said, and there already was a different question. The other question, by the way, which was a, maybe we'll revisit the other question another time. I read the other question and I didn't put it on the sheet because it's not that related to this, but it's one of those that there was a, the Germans came to town and they said all fur has to be given over. And in the event that someone, and they put these three council members in charge of it, say if we find any fur after this afterwards, we will kill whoever had the fur, and we will also kill the people in charge. They found a guy with the fur hat afterwards. As promised, they killed the guy. They beat the first person of the elders to death. They were in the middle of beating the second one to death when the son of the third one paid a guy with a gun to shoot his father so he wouldn't have to suffer.
Oh my God.
And now that son wants to know whether he has to do tshuva for that. So again, wow. So that's the other one. We're not going to discuss that one now because it's not really related to this. Anyway, he wants to know what we care about is the Judenrat here. Yes, Patty.
I'm just saying they're all no-win situations. None of them.
Of course, these are no-win situations. If there was one way to win, it would be easy. Right. This is
The bottom line comes down to: do we try and save some by killing others? That's really where it lands.
Correct. So,
and I don't know what that answer is.
Well, it's a good thing that you showed up at class tonight, isn't it?
It is.
All those wondering why I get paid the big bucks, wonder no more.
To teach me.
So, it says in the Shulchan Aruch, this is what we read last time. It says, Akum Shomer Yisrael, Tu Vanu Achan Michem V'Nahargenu V'Lo Yitnu Ro Echem Mehem Ela Im Ken Yichdu V'Amru Tenu Lanu Ploni. They said that you're not allowed to give over the person unless he says specifically that person. So he said, there's two opinions. One says the person deserves the death penalty, you give them over. And the other says, no matter what, if they say a person in particular, you give them over. He said, what is in this case? They never, ever asked for anyone in particular. A. And B, not only that, but for sure, the Nazis, when they're asking people, it's not that these people deserve the death penalty at all. And therefore, what are we talking about? Now, he goes on to discuss this a little bit more, and I'll just go over it briefly. And he points out that really there are only two things to consider here, right? One thing to consider is that, if you remember last time, we did the opinion in the Tosefta. The opinion in the Tosefta that we discussed last week talks about, well, maybe this only applies when the Jews are inside and the enemies are outside. And therefore, theoretically, some people might survive. However, if the Jews are inside and the enemy is inside, and therefore the person who they want to kill is going to be killed one way or the other, there's no possibility that person's going to be saved. So in that situation, give the person over. That's one point that he makes. The second point he talks about is, well, is he chayav misa kesheva ben bichri? Well, do we say Dina de Malchusa here? Because we're in Germany, and according to German law, Jews have to be killed. Now, needless to say, of course, that second one is, that's not Dina de Malchusa. Dina, that is not really considered the law of the land. Nazi law does not maintain, is not considered law at all. However, yes, maybe everyone would die. That's true. But at the end of the day, this is all theoretical because they didn't ask for anyone in particular. They're telling you, you pick out the people. And once we are told that we have to pick out, no, better you should kill us all than we be involved in this type of action. Now that is the opinion of Nussin Gestetner. He thinks that we fall on the side of no, you do not partake in the Judenrat. Even if it means that, you know, theoretically by killing one you can save the other, we don't do business that way. But of course, this was not a question that was practical, and we do give preference to practical questions. We believe that when a rabbi gets a question that's actually happening, there is a certain siyata d'shmaya, there's a certain divine intervention that's given over to us, which allows us to get the right answer. And therefore, when someone's talking theoretically, they don't get that divine help. It's very interesting. We just had a case recently, a very complex case about a person whose DNA indicated one thing or another thing. And Rabbi Willig, when he was in Israel, raised the question with some of the leading halachic authorities in Israel, and none of them answered him. And in the end, we found out that the facts were wrong and there was no such question. However, the next source that I bring down, which is the final source, is again from the article from 1991 from Shana Bishana, written by Penina Feig, where she discusses the way that the rabbis were or were not involved in these decisions in different European cities, and it's an interesting article, where she says that, in fact, there was definitely three different models, and it was a pretty even split based on what she brought. One was there were times when the rabbis had no say whatsoever. There was a second group where the rabbis were not asked, but they still offered their opinions. And then there was a third group where the rabbis were actually asked. And this is a case of the third group. This is the case of Kovna. This happens to be a pretty well-known case. So we'll go through it. Because at the time in Kovna, was the leader was a fellow known as the Kovna Rav, Rav Shapira. Rav Shapira is better known by the book that he wrote, the Dvar Avram. Dvar Avram is a work on the Gemara. I own a set. I have quoted it. It's a very well-respected scholarly work. And he talks about the fact that on October 26, 1941, the fifth day of Cheshvan, 5702, Bala Misrad Altasnrat, right, which is basically the Council of Elders, Pekid Gestapo b'shem Rauka, Vodiyash Sumunyam Rosas Toshve Hageto Panim El Panim. They have the Gestapo was in the Judenrat, and he says, I want to see all of the Jews face to face. October 28, meaning that in 2 days from now, at 6 in the morning, they will have to go out to the Democrat Square. Right, and they have to divide in the way that is known. Right, on the one hand, the elders' councils, they stand in one place. The police, Amishtaravuchud, Ha'ovdim Bavoda Shonos, again, different types of tradesmen, they will stand together. Kolechavikruzotso. Ahamishtara Yehudis Lamid has called him Komakvum Lahem Lashkia Chalaseder. The Jewish police are in charge of making sure everyone's where they're supposed to be. Hu Yavor Alpine Kol Shura Vishov Yivdok Eitzel Kol Ishvi Isha Estudas Avoda. He will check individually everyone's work papers. Those who are not fit to do their work will be moved elsewhere. Where were they? Well, see, I didn't say where they're going to move them to. They're going to move to the little ghetto. Everyone understood that meant the concentration camps. They're going to go down and they're going to start picking out people and take them to the concentration camps. That was what was going to happen. Divrei Rachos who roshem kashal chavrei altis not made him lich shol yisapim as kol ha'emes. And of course that they did not know what to do, these people. If we're going to tell them, we're going to be giving out people. Ha'gosa shor if ne yeshara shal tuban achrayis ke'echad asherah ha'tragis echin hogs. They were all stuffed with this tragic question about how they should act. Right? Im ramare acher ha'pekuda should they go forward or should they sabotage it by never announcing it? They said, if they give over, so a lot of people could be saved. He'll go through and he'll pick out some and the other he won't. If they rebel and say, we're not doing it, they just might wipe out the entire covenant ghetto. Maybe, who knows? The last second, maybe a miracle will happen. So they thought, really, we shouldn't do it, but they decided rather than make the decision themselves, they're going to go to the Dvar of Ram, they're going to go to the rabbi and ask him what to do. So again, this is a story, it's been told over in many, many different forms. So we have every reason to believe that this is a true story. However, in terms of, you know, what the underlying reasoning for it is, etc., it's a story. It's not a written decision. All we have is what we are told they were told. So they sat in hours and they spoke to him. I'm definitely pronouncing that wrong. He heard the question and he fainted. The pressure of the question was too much. So he said, give me some time. He said, I can't answer on the spot. Can I have a few hours to research the topic?
Tell me what the question was, because I feel like I don't know. I didn't get it.
The question was, do we in fact do what they tell us, line the people up, and have them take who they take, and the rest survive? Or no, are we not going to line up in a way that they're going to start taking people away? And we're not going to, and whatever happens, happens. We will not be party to this. Now, let's take a moment. Is this the same or different than giving over names?
It seems different than giving over names.
Why does it seem different than giving over names?
This big deal about if they name somebody, that we could give over the person. But if
so are they naming somebody here?
It doesn't sound like they're naming anyone.
So then it would be the same. On the other hand, I could hear the argument that they are. They're saying you. They are pointing to the people they want. Now, we're lining them up and allowing them to make that choice.
But in the case where they're giving us names of people they want, there's the case of where they're asking, for example, a murderer, if he deserves it. And they're saying, hand over Akiva ben David. Akiva ben David has been judged by a Roman court to be guilty of murder. That's a different situation than hand over Akiva ben David, we want him.
But let's say they walked in and they just said, you know, Akiva ben David looked at me the wrong way. I want to kill him, or I'm going to kill all of you. He wasn't judged by any court.
But that is more like what the Nazis were doing.
Right. At least they were singling somebody out. It's different than saying, listen, we decided we want to kill a Jew today. Any Jew will do, just give us one.
We don't hand over when they just say any Jew. We don't choose whose blood to spill.
Right. But so here, even if it means saving others. So in
we
this
don't.
Case,
that's one of the Rambams. That's the one we follow in that case. Right. The other one, the case of the Nazis is something different. And it really doesn't conform to either of those Rambams. It may be closer to the case where just hand over a certain amount. Because what they're asking really for in this case is, give us the ones that we've starved enough that they can no longer do productive work, so we can kill them now and not wait.
But again, unlike the case where they're saying, they'll give us the list of names, they're saying, you know, line them up so we can pick out the ones we want, but we're going to pick them. So that might be a very important difference here. So what was the end? L'macharas hodiya harav Shapira she'im ha'altas ternat mekavesh ha'yidei ha'pekuda yara b'yod ratzi afilu cherek levad me'uchrisiyo tageto alov ra'azor ometz ra'kachas ha'latzu ha'tzachrayas l'malei achar ha'pekida. So the bottom line, he said, listen, if you think that this is going to save people in the long run, go along with it. So again, this does seem to be against what we heard earlier, but not necessarily, because it's not asking for a list. It's something different than that. So hopefully next week we will continue, you know, with other issues related to the Judenrat. This is in general the idea of whether you can be a member of the Judenrat. And if you'll accept the idea of Rav Shapiro, in case anyone is curious, was killed by the Nazis eventually in the Holocaust. He was an older man, but he was a great Talmud Chacham whose Torah we still benefit from today. He thought that, you know, if in the long run this is potentially helpful. It's interesting that there definitely were stories of where the Judenrat, there's in that same article they talk about, there was a time when the Judenrat was told to give over 1,500 Jews. And they actually negotiated the Nazis first down to 1,000. And then ultimately, by pulling shtick, they were able to get it down to 406. Now, is that good?
It's less bad.
Right? It's 1,094 or less bad. You know, if they would have just said, jump in the lake, we're not doing it, 1,500 would have been killed.
Or right? More, we don't know. Which is why the rabbi answered wisely. He said, it seems to you, it'll save lives. But that there's implicit in that statement is the idea that you have to use your judgment. And that you might be wrong or you might be right. And it's one of those things that even looking back on it, you're never sure.
Right. But on the other hand, when it comes down to, they say, pick out people and hand them over, you know, there's got to be that line in the sand. So as usual, a intellectually fascinating, but overall terrible topic once again. Hopefully, right. Maybe. So, and tomorrow night, we will